Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harp Song for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. We're on chapter 19, page 63. Oh, sorry, I have a fan on me. I hope that isn't blowing in your ears. I'll move a little bit. We're going to run into a couple really short chapters here. So, sometimes in this period of narrow straits caused by his lean purse, when he was up to his ears in sand, poor Marx did envy those who could reverse themselves and by continual tumbling perhaps get rid of part of their burdens. Sometimes he did wish that he could be buried many fathoms deep, for that would be easier than to try to go on with all the financial burdens which were his in spite of the money Ingalls managed to send, and the money for the pawning of his wife's china and silverware. In September, when with Ingalls' help in footing the bill for the van and horse, which was no doubt as mournful as a hearse driver's horse, Mrs. Marx, big then with the child who was not viable, something that might be half-cindered cherub and half-dead bird with a strangled neck, and that would no more complete its evolution than the Marxist political economy when its author was in the muck and was trying to get out of the hole and was in a quandary because of inability to meet with total payment of rent to the new landlord. Marx had complained in his letter to his Manchester alter ego, if such Ingalls was, that part of what did seem no merely monetary crisis but a continual crisis, just as things were always to be for him in one way or another, and as the world itself was to be, was that his wife's inheritance from her aristocratic von Westphalen family, which he had once described as worshipping God at Trier and the devil in Berlin, had been invested in Lower Silesian Railroad bonds, which were immediately shriveling, dropping down because of the raging credit mobilier swindles, which had aroused scandals in France, and would have repercussions throughout the railroad and banking world, touching upon many lives of people who had never owned a link in a railroad belt or a banker's daisy chain. Ingalls, who had also suffered temporary financial embarrassment, although not to the point where he could not offer bread and wine, never enough to sustain the family in view of how many hungry mouths there were, even if one should subtract the dead child like a little gargoyle who had only a rusted brain pipe, a dead butterfly upon its lips. The dead child was the last son acknowledged by Marx, but not the last son who would be his. What had bugged Marx and Ingalls from the beginning of their cooperative and coordinating relationship, as it would always be through all life's jarring storms, was why the exiles who were in their various coops and disagreed with them seemed to look upon the two as one, as if they were joined each to the other like Siamese twins, and thus should be a two-headed subject followed not by a plural but a singular verb. Always of interest to Marx and probably also to Ingalls had been the scraping, rasping, cawing, clicking, gabbling, gobbling, barnyard sound of German intellectual exiles cooped in foreign lands, and the puzzle as to who supported them, who had provided the gold for the bread. Sorry, I'm tangled up here. Sometimes Alfred Messner, reading Heine's undying poems aloud at the dying poet's bedside, had felt that what he heard was a series of calls from the beyond, the cries of a shade, who upon the darkest shores of Acheron yearned for a world of sunlight. Certainly Heine could never have responded favorably to the commandment once pronounced by Ingalls and shared by Marx, who was more than likely the scientific originator of the logical thought, physicist, beware of metaphysics. Heine's premise had been that there was no religion for the healthy and another Heine's premise had been that there was one religion for the healthy and another for the sick, as naturally Marx and Ingalls, with their flight from supernatural things that had in themselves no power, could not agree, for they were sick, but did not take up a mad palmer's life. One of Heine's favorite passages from the works of Homer in this age of many wanderers was that in which Achilles told Odysseus, "Were you comfortable? Are you my baby boy?" Yes. In which Achilles told Odysseus in the world of the shades that he should not try to console a man who was dying. In the words of the Achilles, with his naked heel, which the arrow had reached, that poor plowman who had no rood of land allotted to him, and not much subsistence to live on, than to be reduced to the realm of a king over the dead, that ever-increasing empire. He himself had foreseen, as he had written in one of his Lazarus poems, no mourning for himself, no whispered masses, and no kaddish, no grandeur, no pomp. But he had thought that if the day were a sunny one, as he hoped, then his wife Mathilde would go strolling on the high bank of Mont Martre with Pauline, and would strew immortelles of dead white and yellow as she wiped a teardrop from her eye. Now in Marx's September letter to Engels, at a time when, as in all other times of his own mortal passage, which he had seemed to think was a one-way journey, his only immortality to be, no matter what the Brahmins and Pythagoras said, that which he might find in planting his seed between the loins of that beautiful but ailing wife's body of which he was the ploughman, Marx had done some rooting around in the dead poet's works in order to come up with a quotation that might well have been, although made in a random way, the correct prophecy as to how the materialistic, many-mouthed Mathilde had behaved on the day of the funeral, where she made no visible appearance among the mourners. One of Heinz's witty remarks, which might still be dug up, was that the bust of Klopstock was mainly important as a place to hang his hat on. Another, which showed his fear of despotic powers capturing the proletariat mob, was that it would be wise for little mice who had no shoes not to go to the great cat shoemaker for such provisions. Toward the end, the incorrigible clown poet had written his poems not by moving his plumed pen, but by moving a piece of paper back and forth, no doubt somewhat like the wings of a bird. Marx had chosen from the Romanzero, written when the poet in his coffin bed under the blue Chinese screen was trying to provide for his wife by publication, so that she might not starve when he was gone, the lines which showed that the female had taken no time for mourning, but at 8 o'clock had drunk red wine and left. That which had appealed to Marx's jackass funny bone, for naturally or supernaturally, he could not have been a believer in the necessity of boarding a train to the future, which seemed to be his in the midst of so many illusory spiritual sources, such as been recognized by Heine, was that the prophecy which the dying poet had made concerning the fat widow's behavior had literally, in English, come to pass. While in Paris, where Mrs. Marx had stopped to investigate the present market value of her depressed railroad stocks, she had been told many details about the frivolous behavior of the fat woman by Reinhardt, Heine's former secretary, who for a time when the dead poet was alive, had served as a conduit for messages to Marx and thus to Engels or vice versa. Many of his messages had been ambivalent of meaning. So this is when he also used fat as a derogatory term. So, in this age of body positivity, yeah, how you look doesn't translate into how you act, but there we are. That which had apparently given offense to Marx was that the somersaulting corpse of the old clown had still been in the death house when Mathilde, with the angelic smile, had been called upon and fetched away from her door by her maquereau, or pimp. Marx had briefly wound up what he had learned, that the worthy messenger, who had smeared soft dung on the German public, had received cash money from Mathilde to glorify this human swine who had tormented Heine to death. One of the contemporary recollections of the dumb Mathilde would be that, in spite of the extravagances showered upon her by the dying poet, even while on his coffinbed he had played on the stock exchange in order to increase his Paris-Strasbourg railroad shares and other shares, she was a slovenly creature who looked as if she were unfamiliar with water. So somehow Mathilde is to blame for something. Like, this is just demonizing a woman in general who, let's face it, he was an old man and needed somebody to take care of him. And there you go. Like artists and anybody like this, yeah, they never did a dish. They never cooked a meal. They never cleaned a dish. They never made a bed. They never did anything. So they had to get women to do it for them. So I don't accept the demonizing of Mathilde. And quite frankly, if he died, she wanted to dance, then so be it. So anyways, yes. Not sympathetic to that. So it's a short chapter, and 20 is even shorter. I'm not sure about 21. Yeah, they're just short chapters. I mean, I think the longest would maybe be about 4 or 5 pages. All right, thanks for listening. Bye.